Hello, welcome back to Kitchen Curiosity, the podcast that delves into the heart of food service equipment and hospitality. And today I'm in London in the recording studio, and I've got three members from Cedar Bond, all distributors and professionals in our sector. And I've actually also got the Cedar Bond marketing company with me today. We're going to be talking about 2025, last year, and what was good, what was not good. We talk about collaboration, market pressures, upcoming trends. We're also going to discuss about the wider sort of UK economy at the moment, and there'll be a few fun questions to catch them out, hopefully. So I'll get on with it, and welcome to the show, Richard. How are you?
Good morning. My name's Richard Jeffries. I'm very well, thank you very much. I'm from Catercall. I'm basically in charge of all the contracts worked, and anything that is customer focused. Our main trade is we're born of a service company, so we are servicing, fitting, repairing, catering equipment. We love heavy duty, we love retrofits and upgrades, and we are delving into sales of equipment.
Perfect. Thank you.
Good morning.
How are
you? I'm very well, thank you. Thanks for
inviting me. You're looking fresh because you and me didn't do the catering at the awards.
No, we stayed away. As you know, I'm Marios Pompouris, Managing Director of Chillerbox. We're a London-based project outfit who primarily design, supply and install commercial kitchens to all parts of our industry. And unlike a lot of our competitors, we also do air conditioning projects as well.
Okay. Right, okay. Yeah. I didn't know that. I've learned something. Yeah,
learned something new.
Carly, good to see you again.
You too, Radford. Yeah, good morning. I'm Carly White. I'm an account manager at Eat PR. We are a PR and marketing agency, and we specialise in hospitality, and that can be anything from some of the big heavy equipment suppliers right through to some consumer goods, and we also do the marketing for Cedar Bond. So we have many clients individually, but we also work with Cedar Bond on raising their profile too.
Fantastic. Thank you. James?
Good morning. My name's James Benting. I work for Caltel Catering Equipment. I'm the sales manager there. We have multiple strings to our bows for our business. We have a hire department. We have a refurbished department. We do sales, service, kitchen projects. So we cover nearly all aspects of catering for a small family business, mainly regional based. So we're in the West Midlands in Shropshire. We cover mainly North Wales and the West Midlands area, but also have a few places we go. Where we get nosebleeds where we go that far. But yeah, we try and stay regional, but cool. It's growing. So yeah.
Fantastic. Well, welcome to the show. Well, anyway, welcome everyone. Thank you for giving me your time on a Friday morning to the recording. So just sort of kick us off. How was 2025 for you as a year? I mean, Richard, do you want to maybe start out?
Yeah, I'm thinking back January, I think we got off to a really good start. Beginning of the year, things were looking positive, and we had a really good sort of first quarter to the year. Mm-hmm. I think there was a bit of indecision in the country around about the middle quarters, and there was a little bit of a lull. I don't know if it's really going down, but just a feel in the air that people didn't want to commit themselves to orders. And then it all came back. So the last quarter of the year, the period that sort of leads up to Christmas, was, I would have said, on the books is exceptional. The only difference I would say from previous years is that we're seeing a lot more project work, retrofits, upgrades in existing formats in the kitchen, as opposed to complete strip outs
sort of
and rebuild.
Out.
Yeah. Mm. So we are seeing a bit of a frugal sort of approach by some companies, but in our world, we are engineers, and that is our bread and butter. So we're looking for that. So.
Yeah.
Okay. I would pretty much mirror that. I think 2024 was a very tough and challenging year. Mm. But as we started 2025, we also found it that it was quite buoyant, or more buoyant certainly than 2024, and we were quite busy up to about the middle of the year. We also saw a little bit of a tail off then around the summer, as you would ordinarily tend to see anyway around July, August time, because it's the holiday season. But then it felt like it was a little bit sluggish in coming back. And I think that very much because of the backdrop of the
pending budget. I felt that the summer holiday almost extended a bit.
Absolutely.
Into like mid-September.
Correct.
I don't know if that's... Yeah.
and that was very much in terms of new inquiries, because obviously, because we're primarily project focused, our sales cycle is not immediate. You know, you don't get an inquiry today and then get an order tomorrow for a full kitchen. It takes time to go see the client, understand their needs, produce a design, get it costed, fit in with their overall program, whatever that may be, which sometimes can be months, sometimes it can be years if it's part of a much bigger project. So there was definitely a lull in those new inquiries, which we then kind of felt going into the autumn in terms of orders coming through. And I think that was exacerbated by the fact that the government, who in my opinion have not been pro-business whatsoever, had this pending looming budget date which was set far too way out, and people did hold their breaths and then kind of
I'm going to hold you on that one, because we're going to cover that in some detail as we get into the show, if that's all right, Barry. Richard saw you.
Well, I was about to say one of the aspects I'd say is that we all service or work for a labour-intensive industry. The hospitality, there's no question of doubt, is labour-intensive. Yeah, yeah. They had the bigger shock of the commercial world when they could see what was happening, and with the NI situations and stuff like that. Yeah. So we put a lot of that downtime or quieter time in the summer, we related it to that. Now, whether we have no facts to prove it, but that's what we were believing.
Yeah, yeah. I think. I mean, when you hear about the rise in the wages bills of operators after that NI change, and that was obviously from the 2024 budget, and then when there was talk of the 2025 budget having more of the same, everyone went, oh, not again, kind of thing, and certainly paused for a moment. But then that said, things have picked up. What it makes you do as a business, especially as a small business, you've got to be dynamic, you've got to pivot, you've got to look at your data, you've got to look at where your inquiries are coming from or the number of inquiries, and you start rehashing your marketing strategy accordingly, which we have done. And we're just starting to see some of the results of that with, again, a flurry of new inquiries, lesser volume, but at least a decent quality of new stuff, which should hopefully see us through into 2026. It should be a better year.
Okay. And James, for you last year, 2025, how was it for your business?
So we've been very lucky in regards to we've had our best year upon year. I think we've flourished throughout turmoil. With turmoil, there's always an opportunity. And where we've really flourished is we've followed around restoration companies who have gone into corporate buildings, especially in London or Birmingham, where everyone's now working from home. There's no need for a big commercial kitchen. So we've gone into those places. We've stripped them down. We've refurbished the equipment and sold them on.
Okay.
So that opportunity has arisen, basically, from everyone now working from home and COVID happening, where that stopped everyone going there. So even though, you know, those kitchens are no longer in use in those places, we've managed to capitalise, take that away, market that out to people, especially in the more rural areas. They're open to those budget savings. We can turn it around. We can use fully qualified engineers to turn that equipment around and reuse it, which comes at a better price.
I think that second-hand market has grown, hasn't it?
It's
considerably
huge,
since COVID. I mean, sometimes I say that word, but
we had to take on a second warehouse too. Yeah,
and seriously?
Yeah. And at the moment, our biggest challenge at the moment is where do we put the equipment that comes in? So, yeah, it's been a great opportunity.
Out of interest, how has that reflected on the price of second-hand equipment?
It's gone up.
Okay.
Yeah.
So even though there's a surplus of stock, but there's also the demand to go with that, is there?
Yeah, because the price of new equipment, you know, every year there's 4 or 5% increases on list price of items. And then in the refurbished market, it reflects that really. You can get equipment for, you know, 50% less than you might pay new for some items, depending on age and things like that.
Yeah.
So it's really... It encourages people to come and see us as well, which is good. It's always good to get people in and have a look at equipment instead of just a lot of the time you just send them a piece of, you know, a PDF with a picture of an image on. They don't really know why that equipment is any different to something else.
I guess some of that kit could be a couple of years old anyway.
Yeah,
maybe so. Yes. Nothing wrong with it.
Yeah, some things are only 3 years old and they were used a week and then the kitchen was shut. So,
oh wow, okay, so literally brand new.
Yeah. Which keeps our overheads down as well when we get the things in.
So. To be fair, I see a lot of that. But I would like to thank you, James, because where you've stripped out the kitchen and left a vacant area, the workforce is now coming back to those offices, so we have an opportunity to fit in new kitchen.
It's a circular economy.
It's a win-win.
Yes.
Carly, from your perspective, I mean, obviously it's a different take as marketing, but you're working with this sector.
Yeah, and first of all, it's great to hear that, you know, we've had years of challenges that are still ongoing, and to hear that all three of you are doing exceptionally well, and love to hear about how you've pivoted and made the most of those opportunities that have come out of challenges. We also have had like exceptional growth. We've literally just moved offices this week. We've doubled in size within the last year. And I think what a lot of people in the sector are realizing, that rather than maybe employ a full-time marketing person, they can pay us to, you know, manage their PR and marketing, and it's not a full-time wage. We will maximize that budget for the clients, and we have a full, a bit like Cedar Bond, a sort of helicopter view of the whole market for, like, you know, whichever part of, where, you know, whether it's the food service side, hospitality, whether it's retail or heavy equipment. And we can share that knowledge within us as a team and really maximise people's marketing budgets by being very targeted to their message that they want to get out. So whether, you know, somebody's doing something great in sustainability, we can focus on that message. Or whether it's apprenticeship training, you know, so we have that expertise and knowledge, and we can maximise probably a quite small budget that wouldn't go very far if it was used internally.
Has marketing kind of changed in the
last? I mean, I'm fairly old, but obviously it's changed. I mean, the fact that I'm sitting here on a podcast, you know, 20 years ago, you know, podcasts are great. You know, we can all sit here and get our own messages across in our own tone of voice. Mm. Back in the day, it was very much print. I mean, there still is a place for print, but there's also digital, social, you know, multi-channels and newsletters. And, you know, that you have to be sort of looking to the right channels for your audience, which is different for every client.
And it's about to change again with AI, isn't it?
Oh.
In terms of
absolutely
what you do in terms of marketing to make sure the AI
and to embrace AI. I think you know, it gets a hard knock all the time, and there are good reasons it gets a hard knock. But equally, we need to embrace it and you know, understand it and move forward with it, like,
and see where marketing strategy fits in with it.
Yeah, and for it to complement what you're doing, you know, not be seen as a be all and end all. But, you know, obviously we're wordsmiths, so like ChatGPT on paper is our enemy. Yeah. But it's not just used for words. You can, you know, use it to advantage as well. So it's about embracing it, I think.
I think there's a couple of things that you brought up there. So versatility is absolute key to survival, and we're all surviving and probably surviving quite well in the eyes of the world. But it's because we are versatile that we're surviving, and it's because we've embraced, you know, I don't really understand ChatGPT because it doesn't come into my world, but I understand internet sales, and they absolutely ruin our world because everybody can buy cheaper off the internet. So one of the things that we've done is actually we've set up an internet arm, so if you can't beat them, join them. So we now have our own internet catalogue on the web. But that versatility thing is absolutely key. Whereas you go back to 2 years, perhaps, look at the profile of our customers, absolutely, totally different to the profile of our customers today. The marketplace is chopping and changing. Businesses are being bought out, being sold, being stripped down. And we've had to react to that and understand who is a good customer, who is a good lead. And we've also looked at different formats of the industry. So we're doing more institution, it's economically sounder. Schools are not going to suddenly run out of money. Yes, they're running on tight budgets, but they are not going to suddenly go out of business. They aren't a threat to us. So that versatility in recognising who to work for and who to champion is absolutely key to our survival.
Mm. My favourite thing that I've seen from AI so far, I don't know if you've seen this, Richard, but when our engineers are going to site or we're going to speak to customers and they've got a breakdown, they turn around to us and say, "I know what that is. I put it into ChatGPT."
Oh, no way.
That's like going to the GPT saying, "I can't prepare."
And now they're right.
And then, no. So engineers will not be replaced by AI anytime soon.
Still a place for engineers in the real world.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're all Cedar Bond members. Obviously, you're Cedar Bond marketing.
Yeah, we are a member as well.
Are you a member as well? Okay. So, why is it important? I mean, everyone kick off to be a member of Cedar Bond. What's it mean to you?
Well, it's networking. Mm-hmm. We've got a trusted place of working with partners. James is a competitor, but he's also a good friend. He's also, we can bounce ideas off. If he needs support, we can give it to him. If I need support, he might be able to give it to me. Mm. And I know that I don't have to vet him again. He's been vetted. Mm. He hits the target and the criteria for Cedar Bond, which is a vetting system at the end of the day. It's all about finance and making sure the guy that you do business is going to pay you and is going to be reputable. So that's a good place to start, because in the marketplace today, we can do credit checks on people, but we don't know more about them than that, what experience tells us.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
And we know that if we talk to each other, we can solve problems. And there are lots of guys there. There are all different trades and all different skill sets. We work together, and it's just somebody's done the pre-vetting and the selection. It's in place for us. We can work together. And it doesn't matter whether it's a service provider or a manufacturer. We can trust them, and that's what it's about.
Yeah, for us, it's that as well. But obviously, ultimately, Cedar Bond is a buying consortium. Mm-hmm. So we see the benefit in trying to focus our sales through the suppliers who are part of that consortium, obviously, in order to maximise the overall sales as the member base.
Okay.
But then, obviously, that comes back to us individually as retros at the end of the year. But also then is the added thing of the networking, is of the meeting up, particularly at the events where you're seeing a lot of suppliers, a lot of members all in a short space of time. So it's kind of time efficient, basically, to catch up with people, whether they are a supplier or another member or whatever.
Would they set sort of the pricing discount structures as a group?
They negotiate as a group. They negotiate terms with the suppliers.
Okay.
You are still free to try and negotiate your own terms, whether that can be bettered, or because you've got a particular relationship, or whether it's payment terms or whatever. But yeah, Cedar Bond as a group will negotiate terms, and they negotiate the retros and the targets that the group needs to hit in order to get different levels of retros, basically. And then they encourage, obviously, us as members, when they can see the figures and they can see that we may be close to hitting a particular level that would get an extra level of retro back, then you'll get that email that comes out to say that, you know, we're doing really well with this particular supplier. If we can do this by the end of the year, we'll get an extra X, and that then benefits all of us as members financially, basically, at the end of the year.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's beneficial financially. Also, like Richard said, it's that commonality of the people in the group. You want to see them do well. You see progress within the Cedar Bond group, because also, if everyone's doing well in the group, the amount that's in the group is going up as well. So it benefits everybody. And I think it's a very level playing field within Cedar Bond, which always helps as well. So yeah, it's been great for us, especially with the networking. We've probably been introduced to more people throughout the industry through Cedar Bond than we have through anyone else. Yeah. So attending the events, meeting suppliers come to see us because they've seen that we're a Cedar Bond member. So yeah, it's really worked well.
And from a marketing perspective, it's just we're obviously marketing from a Cedar Bond angle, which is all about people, partnership, performance, that networking, that value of getting people in a room, the face to face, and being able to have a number of visitors to one stand where you can demonstrate equipment. That's so valuable that you can achieve so much in one day. So we're marketing from a Cedar Bond message, because you all obviously share certain values, that sort of importance of connection and industry networking. But then underneath that, obviously, we can then promote your individual companies. And it's such a diverse mix of members and suppliers. It means that we can kind of keep a consistent overarching message that is Cedar Bond with all you guys underneath it. So it just keeps it tidy. You're not flooding inboxes with 20 emails in one day. We can contain it into one newsletter that looks consistent, hopefully is nice and easy to read. And we can promote your services to each other, which is a huge plus. I think it's a brilliant organisation.
There's also a big efficiency in having a lot of members, which... it's quite difficult to work out who you should be dealing with and who you shouldn't be dealing with. You've got to go and see them at their place of work, and then, are these the company for us? Now, this openness and this networking brings it together. It is quite social as well. There are a lot of good friendships going on in there. But one thing that we have evolved from the showcase sort of days is we now do our sales meets, where we take all of our sales guys and we go to a Cedarbon member, we use their boardroom, and then we learn about their product, their factory, their work. So last week we were at Jestic, MKN, so big supporters of Cedarbons. I take my whole team there, we sat around the table, we do the few hours of catching up on the figures, how are we doing, what are the opportunities, where are we going, are there any threats? Then we come out of that, and then we go through to their kitchens, we look at their products, and they give us a few hours of their time. Now, to get that one-on-one in a complete day, we're not rushing to get there, we're not rushing to get home, that's a significant advantage, because otherwise it would be one sales guy coming with a box and a laptop and setting up and showing us a screen and just giving us the idea of the flavour of what they're doing. But we're actually doing it in reverse. And that's all come about because of this way that we are networking and the friendship element of it.
Yeah, so, you know. Interesting.
Mm-hmm. I can see, you know, obviously, my connection to Cedarbon and visiting the showcase. There's a real sort of sense of community and working together in collaboration. So that kind of brings us on to the next kind of question subject, if you like. So what, from your perspective, is actually selling in the market, what has been selling? And when we talk about selling, we could talk about products or we could talk about sectors like QSR, education, stadium. James, you want to kick us off? What you're seeing is popular, what has been popular?
I think with new technology, we seem to find people very interested in different ways of holding food compared to the traditional way where you might cook things off in the morning. We see people, a lot more people interested in blast chillers or hot holding as different versions of, you know, just putting into fridge, especially with environmental health, getting to people and say, you've got to vacuum pack, you've got to have a blast chiller. Mm-hmm. So with that talk then comes, well, how can we, is there another way to do this, where we see people looking at hot hold? We've been looking at products from like Unox, the Averio, where they can actually hold, they can hold items for days or weeks,
right? Okay.
Which really works into like a labour cost perspective, which people are looking at as well. You know, you could, with that item, you could not have a chef on site. You could just have someone plating up. It's all the innovation within the industry is opening the door to those sort of products. So we see them as growing. But our day to day, we always see people approaching us for combi ovens and dishwashers because it requires a specialist rather than just clicking online. Because they need someone to install it and make sure it's done right. Need someone to sign it off to get the warranty and things like that.
So. Yeah, kind of the basics. But people always want the combis and dishwashers. And,
yeah.
And Mario, from your...
Not seeing any major patterns in terms of particular types of equipment, really. The only thing I would say on that front is, that, you know, we've been in the industry now 21, 22 years. And where back in the day we didn't sell that many combis, most kitchens now will have a combi oven, particularly now you've got the kind of smaller footprint models, the Rationale XS and MKN do a small one, and I'm sure some of the other manufacturers do as well. So that, I think, is something that's almost a given. It's that you need it in most kitchens, and most operators will want one where they didn't necessarily before. But I mean, we work in multiple sectors, from the high street to education to nursing homes to, you know, different types of concepts on the high street, whether they're a Turkish restaurant or whether they're a pizza restaurant or whatever. So it's very much giving a client what they need for their specific operation and really listening closely at brief stage to understand their needs and then applying the right appliances to that operation.
Yeah. I mean, similar to James, but one thing I would say, that there's probably a lot more people asking about speed cooking nowadays. That's something that's really coming into the world.
Okay.
And they're looking at how do they make the cost of cooking less, which is where we're looking at speed cooking, but also induction, which is can be very, very beneficial. I would have to say that there are lots of, when we're talking combis or the pressure cookers and stuff like that, there is a high degree of connectivity cooking, which is possibly above the knowledge of a lot of the operators. The manufacturers may say, oh yeah, it's a must have. You can run it from your phone. You can do it from home. You can do it from here. It's something that's promoted and everybody's talking about it. But the reality is I've never met anybody who said, you know, I've got to have that because of this. Yeah. They have to have a combi oven because they need a combi oven. And the simpler it is, the better in most cases. I would agree
with that. I think sometimes for us, and this is just my experience, the whole technology and even the sustainability conversation is running ahead of some of the operators that we deal with. You know, we've never been asked for anything in the connectivity side. We rarely get asked too much about sustainability in our experience. I think that might be something a bit more for the multi-site operators, the big chains, that kind of thing. But your average independent operator, which is mostly where we sit, isn't overly concerned about that. They're more concerned about getting products that will do the job at a price they can afford within a budget they've got. So they're looking for value, really, within their whatever their value, how they see value, basically.
Mm. So, I think that's a fair comment. And I mean, I see it in my work, people are pushing sustainability, but then, of course, when we get into value engineering,
that all goes out the window.
jump in on that, which I was going to bring up anyway before you kind of went down that route, you know, MKN are the first manufacturer to bring out open data, and I think that's the difference. So the end users can access the actual data so they can then forward program across multi-sites at the touch of a button. They can adjust cooking programs to save energy before it's cooked rather than reacting to that. And I think you're right, it's more appropriate when it's like a massive multi-site operation. I mean, they've got maps of America where, you know, a certain chain, you can see all their ovens across the whole of America. You can tap on one and then you can isolate, and you can do all of that remotely, which is phenomenal for a big operation. But obviously for the smaller operators, it's not as important. But they're the first to offer this open data between MKN and the operator, which is huge.
Quite a big step.
And, you know, for sustainability reporting for these big chains, that's really important. And it is at a point where they will see the return of investment, because they'll be saving so much across, you know, when you've got multiple sites with multiple cooking operations. And you can even actually remotely put in new cooking programs. So if you've got like a Halloween special, you can do all of that remotely. So it does take a lot of the labor out of all the sites, because somebody could, like one person can be doing that from an office in I don't know where. But
creates efficiency.
But and certainly we're writing a lot about sustainability, precision cooking, anything that's got eco features. So, you know, temperature controls that are intuitive, anything that takes any sort of manual labor out. So, you know, talking about MKN again, their wave clean systems and space clean, you can touch a button, leave it, you can get on with other jobs, and you'll come back to a spotlessly clean oven, and you can run it overnight, so you come in the morning and everything's ready to go. So we're definitely seeing a lot of emphasis on anything that saves time, anything that's precision, sustainability, and that connected kitchen is hot. We're writing about that.
Remote diagnostics as well, that seems to be equipment that seems to, like, especially on combi ovens now, see it on dishwashers where people are looking at remote diagnostics so people can see from a tablet.
Well, the MKN system that I talked about with the open data, it will even flag if certain machines are not following maintenance routines. So, you know, if you're going to phone up MKN and say, this isn't working, at a touch of a button, you can go, that's because you're not following the correct maintenance. And that can flag with an engineer before it gets to a point where it's a problem.
Yeah.
So it's helpful.
We're going to do one more question, and we're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back and do some more questions. So you've led me on to quite a nice question. So you're all distributors, apart from you, Carly. What sets a good manufacturer apart from a bad manufacturer? Big question.
I'll start with it. It's about providing a holistic service beginning to end. So whether that's needing support at time of sale, whether that's needing after sales support, training, whether it's about payment terms, it's the beginning to end.
Okay.
And if they falter, a supplier falters on any one of those, then it can cause a problem, or there may be another supplier who doesn't. And so we have a system in our business where we look at the Cedar Bond supply chain first, and we try and have suppliers for each of product categories that are preferred suppliers from that, and then we allocate one as primary, and we'll have a couple of secondary.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as a primary supplier is not performing, then we'll look to the secondary, and it gives them more of an opportunity to come up.
Yes.
And then over the years, obviously, suppliers do come and go from preference.
I suppose if you're leading with certain products, it also becomes you become like specialists.
Absolutely. We don't like to shift, you know, supply chain too much, and we always maintained also as being as independent.
Mm-hmm.
So we've always looked to be as independent as possible with our supply chain, so that we can always give a customer what they need, not what we want to sell them or what a manufacturer wants us to sell them.
Yeah.
So even though we have that primary, secondary cedar bond as our preferences, if a customer comes to me and they want a particular brand of fridges because that's what they've worked with before, the chef likes X, Y, or Z, we don't want to say no to that. And we will always try and source whatever a client requires or whatever's right for a client's needs, regardless.
Okay. Client-led choice is probably where we sit more comfortable, for the simple reason that we aren't a massive distributor. We're at the heart, we're maintenance, so we don't necessarily have that big catalogue. So we're going to listen to the customer, what you want. But to me, the thing that makes the manufacturer stand out, obviously, quality of build and ease of use are important. Yep. But it is all about that after sales service. Can we get the schematics without a big Ferrari? Can we get the access codes to go into the software? Can we get support where we need it? Should there be an issue with anything from warranty? There are some big manufacturers that make it impossible to talk to them, and all they want to do is, oh, well, that's going to cost you a little bit more, or we'll send our own service people, we'll do this. And you've got to trust these people, because if you have a manufacturer and they send their service team, you then got somebody else's service team in your playground, and you don't necessarily want that.
No.
we would rather do our own works. We would rather have the schematics in front of us and the profile for testing and that little bit of support. So if they're going to help us train, if they're going to give us the schematics, if they're going to do a good product, if they're going to listen to us and say, look, we're right on the edge of selling this, but you can buy it off the internet of somebody else. If they all work with us, then that's a good manufacturer, because we're going to go back to them and back to them and back to them. And that's we keep it simple. That's where we're at.
I think that works against the internet market. If you're going to a customer and they're saying, why should I use you over the internet? You say, well, I have the manufacturer's support. They will, if you speak to the manufacturer, they'll say, you should be using these guys, because, you know,
it's about giving them a value proposition over the internet, because otherwise you're commoditizing the product, aren't you?
Yeah.
Mm. Basically, if it's only been bought on price, then there's no added value. So as distributors, it's about how do we give that added value, and therefore the support that we get from manufacturers is paramount to providing some of that added value, basically.
I think a lot of people don't understand when they buy from the internet. It's literally,
it's a box.
It's dropped at the curb.
Correct.
Yeah. Probably out of warranty.
Correct. Yeah. And then you've got a problem, you're dealing with a call centre and someone that you don't know and whatever. So that personal service. But it has to go back to back with the manufacturers in order for us to be able to deliver that service that we're selling ourselves on and going out to the market and saying, this is why Chillerbox is better than the internet or better than the next distributor or whatever. But if we're not getting that in any way, you know, if it falls down in any way from the manufacturing side, then it can reflect on our service, and then that needs to be attended to.
Obviously, we're in the UK, we're in London recording. What do you see as overseas manufacturers coming into the UK? What do they underestimate about our market compared to other markets?
First of all, it's saturated, you know. even when we have new suppliers coming to us trying to sell us their dishwashers or their ovens or their whatever, it's like, well, you know, we've got enough products there already.
Yeah.
How many more brands of fridges can I take on? How many brands of dishwashers can I take on? So for complete newbies coming into the marketplace, you know,
it's tough.
It's got to be tough, especially where they've got no previous history. And even the ones that have got previous history, you do see them bouncing around, some of them, that whether they try and do it for themselves or they find UK agents and they're with them for a little while and then it doesn't work for whatever reason, and then they disappear and then they come back and then someone else tries to take them on. That just shows how tough the marketplace is. Mm. And I think that is because, you know, it's a fairly saturated market, and it's probably, I don't know what the figures are exactly, but I would say it's kind of pretty much plateaued over the last 10 years or so.
James, what do you think about overseas manufacturers trying to enter the UK?
Yeah, I think it's... It would be great if we seen more UK manufacturers. I think that would be a real
yeah, that's a good way to flip it on it. Yeah.
But you don't see many. Most of it imported. We see Italian, German manufacturers. We see Chinese manufacturers. We even now see Italian, German manufacturers, but it's actually manufactured in China. Mm. So you can see it's from our side, it's distinguishing the quality between the items that are coming in as well. So we have to assess that before we tell the customers, you know, do we think that's the product for them? And again, with them, is it coming down to price or is it coming down to longevity? So yeah, they're the challenges really. There's a lot on the entry-level market in the UK, I would say. I haven't had much experience with the European market, but I always hear that the UK has a particular entry-level, a lot of entry-level, like refrigeration, things like that, where possibly other places might not as much.
Okay.
So yeah, it's
there is too much choice, I do feel choice also shoots the buyer in the foot sometimes. They might think they're getting a bargain, but I would say to anybody who's out there buying commercial equipment, you've got to be looking at this at least a 7-year proposition. You're not buying it for year 1 and 2, but in years 4, 5, and 6, it is going to break down. There is no appliance that has a heavy workload that breaks down. Now, if you're new to the market, new to the country, there's only so many parts that Parts Town can hold. They cannot take every single part. So you're either running it off spurious parts or you've built something that's unique. Well, if you're running it off spurious parts, might be cheap to buy some of them, but you can guarantee it's not as good a proposition. It's not going to last you the 7 years. So you've got to have the business, all the appliance-specific parts in there that they've manufactured to go in there. And there's no way that the likes of Parts Town can just keep on increasing the size of their showrooms. So what are we going to do as a service company? How are we going to get these parts? So the customer, for 3 years he's had a brilliant appliance, then it breaks down. And they phone us up and we'll say, well, actually, we've only ever seen two of these in the country. And why would they hold your parts? We're going to have to go all the way to China. So that appliance has just doubled in cost. Enough is enough, I would say. You can't stop it. It's a free market. But in all seriousness, we've clubbed together as Cedar Bond because we've got parameters to work to, and we want to make it work, and we want to do what's best. And we want to make it efficient for our clients. So if they're going to ask us, do I buy this? Never heard of it before, but it looks, good value. I'm only going to say no.
It's encouraging the end user to do their due diligence.
Yeah.
They should always have a look. Can I get parts for this? Can I get my local service provider to fix this item? These are questions that every single person should ask themselves before buying a piece of equipment. We get phone calls all the time where they ring up, and I'm not going to name the brand, but they'll ring up and say, can you fix this? It's broken. We say, no, we can't get the parts. We can't get hold of the people there. We can ring them. We'd get the same number that you get if you rang them, where you go press 1 for to speak to nobody, press 2 to speak to nobody else. So we're in the same situation as them. So we'd always encourage people to check those things before they look at purchasing equipment as well.
Well, some good food for thought there, and any overseas manufacturers listening might want to take note. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to come back and have a few fun questions and discuss more. Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by Cedar Bond, a UK buying and marketing consortium for the food service equipment sector. For decades, Cedar Bond has connected dealers, suppliers and partners to drive value, collaboration and long-term success across the industry. Cedar Bond is proud to be part of HRC 2026, the UK's flagship hospitality and food service show, taking place from the 30th of March to the 1st of April 2026 at XL London. Don't miss the brand new Cedar Bond Village, a vibrant hub bringing the Cedar Bond community together right at the heart of HRC. To find out more, visit hrc.co.uk.
Well, Well, welcome back. Thank you for joining me for the second segment of the podcast. We're going to kick it off with something a little bit different. A couple of fun questions, if you don't mind, just to lighten the mood. So, and anybody can go first. So you're on a, and Carly, you've got to get involved as well.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah, I'm here.
You're on a desert island. Pick wherever you want it to be.
Nice.
You're allowed to take one cooking appliance, one refrigeration item. We don't have to name the brand, but you can say the item. You know, you can name the brand if you want. And one wild card. And then why are you taking it? Go on then, Richard. You
well, right. The obvious truth, I like meat, so I am going to buy one of James's reconditioned char grills. I just love the char grill flavour. Obviously, if I've got that, I need a prep top saladette with fridge at the bottom and then quick choice of toppings, garnishes and everything else.
Nice. Steaks and burgers.
Yeah, and nothing else needed, but the wild card, it's something close to my heart. I am going to stick a Big Dipper in there to siphon my grey water and stop all the fog polluting the that is a thing that is happening in London and has to be resolved, so I'm going to have one. I'm not going to pollute the Pacific or wherever I am. I'm going to make sure it's all good quality and the grease is removed.
The char grill was what I was going to say as well. It's a popular choice. Mine was going to be a char grill. An ice machine, especially if it's going to be a warm desert island, and possibly a fish counter.
Nice.
So right, I've got the display, and I've got the.
So you're going more fish than meat.
Yes.
Yeah. I guess with the desert island, should be plenty of fish.
Yes. Oh yes. Yeah.
If you can catch them.
Yeah. So yeah, that would be
cool.
Go for it.
Excellent. I'm going to go for the excess combi, Rationale excess combi that I mentioned earlier, because it's such a versatile bit of kit for cooking. Can cope with lots of things, so definitely have that for the cooking appliance. Probably having a Dande refrigerated drawer with a freezer option, so that we can chill and freeze as necessary. And then a little bit like you, I want an ice flaker, because if I'm on a beach, I need a cocktail. And the flaked ice is a must for the mojitos.
Oh, are we going connective cooking here? Or
I don't want to be connected to anyone.
No.
That's what I'm going to do on my own.
I can't function without coffee. And I'm ashamed to admit I can't drink instant coffee. So I would be taking a coffee machine. A milk frother, which we've recently got in our new office, and it's literally a game changer. And I'd probably take a pizza oven because
great. So pizza and coffee.
I'll be the size of a house. But
I can hear a trip to Smeg going on here.
I go with you with the pizza, but I was thinking like maybe like a kegerator or something, so you have like beer on tap.
Course, yeah.
That'd be great.
Yeah, nice.
Good choice.
Yeah. Okay, so something a little bit maybe more serious, but thank you for that. Some different things, some good things there. Just to recap on what we were talking about before, about how, like the UK wider economy, I mean, what I've been seeing is that people are stalling on making decisions. It's all kind of like last minute. So all of a sudden, yeah, we've made the decision and we want it tomorrow. I mean, that's exaggerating, but do you find...
Absolutely. One thing I can tell you, with contracts and where you have policies to say that you need two services a year or whatever to fit in with SFG20 regulation and stuff like that, what people are doing is they're expanding the length of the year by holding back the purchase order.
Yeah.
So the purchase order is saying you need to have two services over 12 months, and this is a 24-month contract, therefore there are four services. But if your contract was due in January and they don't give you that purchase order till April and then say, can you do the service straight away, they have now just gained 3 to 4 months and extended that 24-month period to a 28-month period. So they've just saved themselves two-sixths of the cost. And, I don't think that's anything new. I don't think it's a strategy. It's holding back bills, basically, which is what FM companies do all the time. They just delay payment. But this is actually delaying the ordering, which is slightly different. It's logical, really. But we're seeing a lot of that. And it's partly because people don't want to commit, but they're just looking at ways to, actually, I've got this much to spend, and if I actually push it through to here, it's coming on another budget in 2 years' time. I don't worry about that. So we've seen a lot of that. And, yeah. People are sitting and waiting, and then they'll come. You know that thing you quoted last February? Well, okay. Got to give you the order now, and I'm wondering, can you install it on Monday? That's going to happen. But as I say, it's just a sign of the times, and can you blame them? Probably not, no.
I mean, I think what you're experiencing there is what a lot of us are experiencing in different ways on a micro level, but I think it all stems from the more macro level, which stems then, you know, all the way from global events. So we've had a period now for the last 5 years since, well, six years since, from Brexit to COVID to the Ukraine war, energy crisis, cost of living crisis, change of government, the other war in, obviously, Gaza. So that general backdrop, I think, is just everyone feels a little bit gloomy.
Cautious.
Yeah, and then that's resulting in the caution. It's making it difficult for whatever government's in power, but neither of our leading parties have been particularly great at dealing with things. It was time for change, in my opinion. I don't want to get too political, but in my opinion, it was time for change with the Conservatives to go out. But we've had a government that's come in that, as I mentioned earlier, I don't feel is pro-business.
Business, yeah.
None of their policies seem to be really about growth, or certainly not attracting growth. Mm. And that just makes it, you know, very challenging.
It's been harder,
very, absolutely. It's been a very challenging period. With not a hell of a lot of confidence on the horizons, but at the same time, we're all doing what we need to do, keeping our heads down, cracking on, talking to our clients, making sure that we're pivoting our marketing that we also talked about earlier accordingly, and just keeping going as best, you know, we can under these challenging circumstances.
Mm. I mean, interesting, I was a few weeks ago in Germany, and they were actually saying a similar sort of thing. And talking about the rate of VAT that they've got on hospitality, which is a big subject that we keep talking about here.
Yeah.
So it seems that it's maybe not just, it's quite a...
I think it is global.
It's across the world having the same issues that governments.
I believe so. I mean, even when, you know, you go on holiday and you talk to people, you go into restaurants and you talk to operators and whatever, I think the general message, you're absolutely right, is more or less the same almost wherever you go, basically, which... it'd be nice to see some boom times again.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, I think people being hesitant is top down. I think that the government themselves are hesitant because in the UK we have a problem with productivity and growth. That's all you ever hear.
Yeah.
And they are very hesitant to do anything radical to encourage growth or productivity in the UK, especially to help out the hospitality industry. Like, no one could probably think of 5 things off the top of their head that's been done to try and encourage growth or productivity in that sector. So I think that's the biggest challenge. And so far, I haven't heard any politician come up with, or anyone in the cabinet come up with an idea to help boost that. I don't know if, you know, a cut on VAT for the food sector in general, maybe to encourage people to go out to get more money in the pocket, you know, maybe it's something as simple as that, but something, you know, otherwise it's just going to continue, you know, you keep trying the same thing.
In certain areas, it's a vicious circle, isn't it? Because prices are going up because operators need to make a margin, and then that's stopping people from going out because they've got less money in their pocket anyway. But when it's, you know, you're in London and it's costing nearly £10 for a pint, well, no wonder you're walking past pubs on a Saturday night and there's no one in them.
Yeah.
Mm. You know, it's not an easy sector to be in at the minute.
No. Yeah. But hopefully things will be brighter for this year, 2026. We have to hopefully see a brighter.
Be positive.
Be positive,
regardless.
Be positive. So we're going to just change it up a little bit now, do something different, but hopefully we'll see how the results go. And Carly, you've got to play along as well, if you don't mind.
Yeah, I'm here.
James, I'm going to put you under a bit of pressure. Sorry, I know you're going to have time to prep for this. So I'm going to ask you to tell us one truth, one lie. It can be industry, it can be food, it can be work, it can be home, it can be whatever you want. And then we are going to try and work out which is the lie and which is the truth. There might be a prize for the winner. I don't know.
So my first one is that we recently installed a commercial kitchen. And then when we came back to the site, we found out they weren't using any of the commercial items, and they had five or six air fryers in the kitchen.
Okay.
So that's one.
Right.
And my second one is that we sold a customer a huge brat pan, and then we came to site to see what they were using it for, and they had paid a lot of money for it, and they were only boiling two or three eggs a day
in the brat pan.
Yes.
Okay.
Are we allowed to guess?
Yeah, yeah. Guess by all means, or think what you think. Yeah.
I reckon number one is true.
Okay, don't tell us, yeah, James, is it? Marius, what do you think? I quite like the egg story, to be honest.
Yeah, I love the egg story.
I think you're talking about Bob Mortimer.
I love the idea of five air fryers in a row, just cooking up everything.
You've been watching too much Jamie's air fryers.
My dad, nothing is safe in my parents' house from my dad. Like, cheese sandwiches end up in air fryers, all sorts. He's done everything in there.
Yeah, I think I'm going to go with the air fryer one. They've become
the truth.
Yeah, they've become so popular with everyone.
You can see,
yes, yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to go with the egg.
as the truth.
Yeah.
I'm egg as well, actually. Yeah. I think you're right. Sounds
convincing.
Go on, James. What?
The truth is the air fryer.
Yes.
Oh, damn.
Yes. Yeah. So, yeah, we did it. It was like a semi-commercial installation, but yeah, we... Yeah,
and then, so you went back, and then they were literally just cooking everything in air fryers.
In air fryers, yes.
Right. Can you say what kind of food it was? Should I go that far? Was that giving away too much information?
I bet it was yellow.
Yes.
So it was. We initially thought that they would be better with a combi oven for what they were doing,
right.
But we scared them with the idea of the combi oven. So we put in, you know, an induction range, and then got back and realised they were just using those air fryers. Well, the combi oven is could have done what this does.
They created their own combi oven
out of five
individual.
Yeah.
I've got visions of it all being plugged into one sort of big multi plug
and then
an extension lead.
Connected cooking.
Okay, well that was
brilliant.
We lost Richard.
Yep. So I'm looking at a little bit on the sustainability front or what have you, but the two subjects I would have is if you are looking to change Cook Island, Cook Line suite, what have you, within a couple of years, an induction suite will save you money or not. My view is that I know what the trade are telling you, it's going to save you money, but do you feel that an induction, given all of the properties and economy, is it going to save you money? Yes
that's,
or no?
That's the first one, yeah. Okay.
And then the second part is if you are looking not to be prosecuted for discharging fat oil and grease, fog, into the sewer system, there are only three points that have to be proven to make a prosecution start or get the prosecuting start. And those three points are, do you cook food? Do you discharge your water, and does that go to a public sewer?
Wow. So there's it. That's. I mean, you've deviated slightly from the truth and lie, but I'm going to give it you. I'm going
to. My brain doesn't think quick enough. We're on the spot questions, but it's quite. So we have a scenario here. Is something going to save you money? Is that a truth? And is it a truth that you only have to prove 3 points? To commence with a prosecution for discharging?
I'm going to go first this time, if that's all right. I think the induction will save you money, but it is about use. So the answer to that is no, because it is about how you use it. So I think your first one is the fog thing is the truth. That's what I think.
James might know this because he's been to a couple of seminars.
Yeah, I think it's the... fog is the truth, mainly because I know you're very passionate about it. I know that you really know what you're talking about with that. So yeah.
I'm going with number two because I haven't got a clue.
<That's>
on either, but that sounded quite specific. So
well, yeah.
Yeah, I would say number two as well.
Oh, you got me.
You knew your stuff too well.
It's a
simple benchmark. It's not used very often. It's a very simple benchmark, and it's so easy to prove.
Yeah, true.
I'm just going back to induction.
Maris.
I have. Right, so first one, many moons ago, we were doing a complete new kitchen. The client decided that they would cut corners with their gas supply and basically didn't go via the correct channels to upgrade the gas supply. When we came to install the equipment or sign off the equipment, the pressure was inadequate, but they had this looming opening date. So they ended up having to open this beautiful new cook line with all these new Blue Seal appliances. And they ended up opening with countertop gas appliances that they had to hire in with LPG things and loads of flexible hoses on the thing. That's one. And then the other one is the client who refused to spend money on induction, getting decent quality induction units, and would just buy Buffalo units from Nisbets and
other brands available.
And just use them as disposable products. They never lasted very long. They would use them for as long as they lasted. Excuse me. And they felt the cost of continually replacing them every few months was
more cost effective than actually buying. Okay. Yes.
I think number two is probably true, but it's true in the sense that I've seen that myself. and number one, I hope, as we have a higher company as well, I hope that isn't true, and I hope it wasn't us that brought all them bottles into that kitchen. Because
I agree with you, James. That's what I think.
They could both be true, because both scenarios can happen. Certainly the induction range thing, I see it all the time. And people are willing. You're paying 165, 170 quid for a unit. It's neither here nor there. And they do a good job for a year or two. So there's no, doesn't matter where you buy them from. The gas thing, there's a couple of question marks here, because I understand drops in pressure. You've got too many things on the line. But suddenly, if you're introducing LPG, LPG is a higher pressure gas. Suddenly, your extract system, your ventilation, your carbon monoxide readings in that room would suddenly go through the roof if you're suddenly burning it from LPG. So I think if somebody is going to test it and set it up, it's going to fail if it was set up for a nat gas system. So I'm saying that's the lie.
Poor Carly.
I'm just going to say number one, and that's all I'm saying.
Well, I've been a bit cheeky. Richard was actually right. They're both true.
Oh, come on. That's a trick.
Last year, we're based in Wiltshire, and we took part in a waiter's race around the Royal Crescent in Bath. And it was renamed the Royal Croissant.
A waiter's race.
So we had chef's hats and a tray and a glass and a croissant. Sorry, this is really bad. I can't think of another one now. So, well, just decide, is that true or false?
Yeah.
It's absolutely true.
That's so bad. It's true. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, we're going to give you that because you're up against hard competition.
Trying to make it vaguely industry led.
That was actually quite tough.
So, look, we're coming to the end of the podcast anyway. And I've got just one or two questions for you. So, Richard, what keeps you in this industry? I mean, why are you here?
Well, this is the only industry I've ever known. I started it in 1979 in commercial kitchens, and I've never been anywhere else. And to be fair, I love it. I love going into kitchens. Mm. I love the products. I love I'm in two different sort of worlds. I've got the hospitality world, which I go and see on a daily basis, and I meet people. These are the chefs, these are the creatives, these are the managers, and they're always flamboyant, they're always a little bit extrovert, fun would be the word, and that's a lovely world to go into. So I see that side of the fence, and I enjoy going out myself, but I see the other side of the fence, the engineering side, the distributors, the install side, and that's a very different world. It is a niche world, it's close-knit, we get on well. As I say, Cedar Bond has proven this, and I just like the buzz, the feel, the camaraderie. It's us against the rest of the world. We're fighting everything. We're fighting the government and their systems. We're fighting the manufacturers that are coming in from those places that aren't yet established here and flying in. You know, and we're standing our ground, and we've got a challenge, and we're meeting that challenge. And it's just good to be part of something that's positive. And I can't really say any more than that. I love it. And, you know, after 40-some years, I think maybe it'd be a bit late to find out I would champion the wrong...
Thank you for that, Richard. Yeah. Marius?
I'd agree with some of that sentiment there. It's a great industry to be involved in. Hospitality is dynamic. There's great characters in it. Within our world, as the equipment supply side, it's a community. There's that community spirit, which is great. And for me, I like the challenges of running a business. After sort of 22 years, I couldn't really see it any other way in terms of being an employer working for somebody else. And the bits that I really like out of that is the marketing side, creating new business, creating leads. I like closing deals, so going and seeing clients and, you know, understanding their brief and getting a design done and getting it costed, but then actually getting them to sign on the dotted line. And then, as you know, my background, I'm actually a chartered surveyor and project manager by profession.
Okay.
So I like project delivery as well, and I get a buzz out of finishing a project and seeing what went from a design on paper to a complete kitchen, delivered, installed, tested, commissioned, handed over, training, and then a happy client at the end of it, basically. Yeah, ready to go.
Okay. Can't speak for you, but...
Well, I mean, career-wise, I've been in food and drink for a long time, but historically, I was more branding and consumer goods, which was... I really enjoyed that, but it was a very slow process, whereas, jumping over to this side of things, it's so fast-paced, it's really exciting... I've learned so much. I feel like it's a very collaborative industry where people support each other. Obviously, eating out is very emotive, but whether it's a, independent fast food chicken takeaway right through to Michelin star, or if it's in a school or a hospital, there's just so much emotion around food, and it's a real privilege to talk about it and all those different facets within the industry. It's a real privilege to tell those stories.
Cool. Thank you.
Yeah, people and opportunity, really. Got to meet some really good people within the industry. I get to go and see the end users, and you establish all these connections and the opportunities as well, like today, sat in London doing this, which, without the catering industry and what we're doing, I wouldn't be here now. So just to gain these opportunities, it's absolutely brilliant. Really enjoy it.
Perfect. Well, that concludes the podcast. Thank you all for coming along today. I hope you've enjoyed it.
It's been great. Absolutely. Really. Thank you. Good.
Well, we've had a brilliant conversation, honest, energetic, and we've heard some funny stories from all of our guests. A huge thank you for all the listeners for tuning in, and also to the guests for your expertise and your experiences. Coming up later on in the season, we've got other manufacturers coming on. We've got the water board coming on to talk about actually a subject Richard's going to love. And we've got a few overseas travel visits coming up as well. If you've got anything you'd like me to cover or any questions you want me to ask the guests, please email me on radford@kitchencuriosity.co.uk. I've been your host, Radford Chancellor, and you've been listening to Kitchen Curiosity.
Kitchen Curiosity is written and hosted by Radford Chancellor and is edited and produced by Tom Anderson. Kitchen Curiosity is a Sound Rebel production.